This is Sierra Dahl with Municipal Sustainability and Energy Forum, and this morning we're discussing some updates on community choice aggregation, particularly in California, but also in different parts of the country. So Rick Brown with Terra Verde Renewable Energy is going to start us out, and then followed by Sam. Go ahead and start, Rick.
Thanks, Sierra. So, you know, I won't spend too much time on basics unless people have questions, but I'll just give a quick overview and then kind of dial into what's happening, sort of what's on the front burner for many of them today, which is, you know, it's burning pretty hot. As many of you may know, the CCA movement in California has accelerated significantly in the last few years, and we're now to the point where we're losing count. There's probably there's somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 operating CCAs at the moment. Every single county in the Northern California Bay Area has a CCA of one form or another, the most recent being one in the city of San Jose, very large city you all know about, that is launching its and enrolling its first customers in February. And the other major development is the one in L.A. County, CPA, Clean Power Alliance, that's covering many of the cities and parts of L.A. that aren't covered by the municipal utility, LADWP, but also including parts of Ventura County next door to L.A. County. So rapid growth at this point. I think the number is about 7 million accounts covered in California, and on a path that would lead to, you know, over a majority of counties in California being covered by CCAs as early as 2022. Now, one of the headwinds that has occurred in the last year is that the California Public Utilities Commission, which has some authority over this CCA development, and we can talk a little bit about that, why I mean some, because there's debate about the degree of their authority, given that these CCAs are governed themselves by publicly elected officials who are representatives of the jurisdictions that make up the CCA through a joint powers authority. And there is.
Let me just interrupt for 1 second here. We're getting some background noise, so make sure, everybody, that you have your phones muted, because I don't have everybody muted. So go ahead, Rick. Sorry.
Yeah, no worries. Anyway, there's some tug of war around, you know, what authority does the CPUC have over CCAs around various kinds of issues? What authority do the CCAs themselves reserve for themselves? But going back to my major point is that the CPUC this year did institute some rulemaking, which the CCAs are generally going along with, that has essentially resulted in a delay period for some of the CCAs who wanted to get forming and up and running in this year. They're being delayed in terms of when they can launch their programs in order to basically comply with a ruling from the CPUC around some of their planning or around procurement efforts. The second thing, and potentially more significant, is that the way in which the a calculation is made on the cost of the departing load of customers from the incumbent utility, the investor-owned utility, to the CCA, how that cost is calculated, and that in California, that's called the PCIA, and that's an adder to a CCA customer's bill to essentially pay for the fact that they've departed from their IOU and left that IOU with a contract to provide power that is going to have to be paid for somewhere or another. How that number is calculated has been went through a major ruling process before the CPUC over the last few months. The ruling that came down was the worst possible outcome for CCAs of the various ones that were under consideration. And it's going to have a significant impact on the economics of the CCAs. All of them are essentially are currently saying, at least publicly, that they'll be able to absorb those costs and still maintain their, price premium or, reduction from what the incumbent utility would charge for the customers. But it's definitely going to put a squeeze on that. And more importantly, it's going to put a squeeze on their ability to, beef up their balance sheets and or have funds available for more innovative type program strategies to manage their costs through DER deployment, for example, which is an area that I'm personally involved in. And I think Craig Lewis is on the phone, and he's also involved in various ways. So the current political climate is kind of tense. The four mayors of the four largest cities in California, who all have CCA, San Francisco, Oakland, San Jose, and now LA, all registered very publicly their opposition to this ruling by the CPUC. There are lawsuits being contemplated against that ruling. There are legislative responses being contemplated. So I don't think the story is over, but that's my short summary of what the current affairs are in terms of the CCA situation in California. And I definitely would, turn to Samuel to provide more detail and maybe correct me where I may have been inaccurate here.
All right, super. Samuel, do you want to go ahead and add to that?
Sure. And is Craig on the line yet?
Craig is going to be a little bit late, but I know he's coming. He said he's about a half an hour late.
Okay. Thanks, Rick. Those were great insights. Taking a step back and looking at California, we're not a restructured market like all of the other community choice states, and so we've always had this issue of, if the utilities have under contract, if the utilities are only buying 20 to 40% of their requirements from the market and short-term contracts each year, and the rest is all under longer-term contracts, what do we do once CCAs kind of exceed, once they actually need to start buying power from those same assets? So there's kind of a fundamental challenge here that has to be managed. And then we also don't have a centralized capacity market like other ISO RTOs. The legislature has always leaned on the utilities to do that. And so at the political level, there's this perception that we're going to have to come up with an alternate mechanism as the CCAs take over the market and the utilities are long for all their renewables. And so those kind of two issues are creating a lot of confusion. So this is going to be the most interesting year to date, I think, at the legislature. And it's going to be, I think, the first year where community choice agencies kind of proactively pursue new legislation, because often we just play defense against whatever gets thrown at us. But now's the time to, define our vision of the future and start having the conversations around how our market structure should evolve. So Rick brought up the PCIA issue, and I agree with him. That's probably the decision that was put out by the commission is probably the worst that it could have been. In particular, one thing I'd like to point out is that there were two decisions. There was what the judge wrote, and then there was what the commissioner, Peterman, wrote as an alternate. And the alternate ended up getting adopted by the commission. And it's being protested by CCAs and a lot of parties for various reasons. But the commission likely won't grant a rehearing of that. And so it may actually have to, the CCAs might actually have to sue the CPUC in the courts to revise any of that and, going forward. There's also a phase two of that decision where a lot of the more structural issues will be addressed and resolved. But so Peterman's decision had a few surprising elements. She removed the 2019 cap on the PCIA that was proposed by the judge, and so she let it float freely. And it's going to hit all of these CCAs with a significant headroom decrease at 3 months' notice. So that's a bit irresponsible from a regulatory and market stability perspective, whereas the judge's decision would have allowed, would have put in a cap in 2019 and then allowed a true up to actuals to be tracked in a balancing account and recouped over a multi-year period to make everyone whole, which I think a lot of us thought would have been the financially sensible thing to do. Instead, you know, it's going to be a bit of a price shock to many of these agencies. She also, Commissioner Peterman, removed the 10-year cap on cost recovery for utility-owned generation, which has been just kind of a fairly, you know, that it's in several, there's been several instances where the legislature has directed this and the commission has followed through with this, where the utilities should have been encouraged to transition to a more competitive market framework, a more restructured market framework. And so one way to encourage them to do that was to say, you know, there's a 10-year cap on cost recovery for utility-owned generation. And so Peterman just removed that, and she put all the utility-owned generation into the PCIA, in other words, making them eligible for indefinite cost recovery into the future. And so I took that as a signal that, you know, the commission was going to support kind of centralized procurement options going forward, not a more competitive structure of procurement that the CCA industry has been pursuing. And this other, let's see, on that front, there's been legislation introduced this week to create a centralized state procurement agency. And SDG&E told the legislature that they would like to get out of the business entirely and be made whole for all of their utility-owned generation and to transfer all their renewable contracts. And so you put all of this together, and it's kind of hard to read the tea leaves on where it's all going. So I can stop there, or I could talk about more what CCAs are starting to do from a business model perspective. To what would you like, Sierra? Is Craig on?
Yeah, Craig just joined us here. Why don't you do that a little bit, and then all right, let's go with Craig. Craig, are you in a position where you want to say something right now?
You know, why don't I'm not quite sure who that was talking, but it sounded like a really interesting topic. I'd rather let him continue, and then I'll chime in. It might give me a little bit more framework of what I've missed so far. I'm very very sorry for being late.
Oh, no problem. Oh. And that was Samuel Golding. So.
Oh yeah, super. Yeah, let Samuel keep going, and then I'll say a few words after.
Yeah, that's okay. The plan. Go ahead, Samuel.
Hi, Craig. Okay, so
hi there.
From the CCA's perspective, you know, these agencies have collectively entered into 2,000 megawatts of new capacity for renewables to be built in the state, and half of those were signed in the last year, and there are more, you know, major deals underway, and these are, you know, being financed and built by the project development community, and they don't have guaranteed return on those. They don't, CCAs don't have non-bypassable charge cost recovery authorities. So it's the only recourse that these developers have are to the CCAs themselves, not even the governments that have formed the CCAs, just to the joint powers authorities and the expected future revenues from their customer base, which can always opt out and go to the utility. And so it's, you know, I view this as a competitive procurement market, which, you know, California's never really had. We've just, to date, you know, guaranteed, put ratepayers on the hook for full costs of anything that the utilities have contracted for. And so there's, I don't think the legislature quite understands that, or the benefits that could accrue to the state in terms of price discipline, financial and technological innovation through a more competitive procurement framework going forward to towards our 2045 100% clean goal. So I think there's going to be a kind of an educational campaign this year to really let the legislature know about that sort of perspective, and also about what community choice agencies in California are in practice. You know, there's been a very rapid evolution of the business models over the last 2 years, and so the agencies are structuring and managing diversified portfolios of power. They're increasingly, you know, hiring expert staff in those positions. It's 180 employees of CCAs now. These are essentially government employees who are in the day-to-day business of running a competitive power agency with long-term contracting responsibility, and they're supported by a variety of expert service providers. And they're bringing kind of new talent and new perspectives in, including from more, you know, competitive restructured markets. And all of that's new in California. We've never had that sort of very, you know, expert government staff involved in these policy discussions. And so what I'm hoping is that the legislature starts to realize that it can, you know, out of all the people to around this table that they could be trusting and listening to going forward as we decide how to restructure this market, I hope they'll start to see that community choice agencies are kind of the best fit there, kind of, you know, regulator 2.0, if you want to think of it that way. So that's, yeah. And so on the business model side, I also, we've been seeing a lot of innovations around DER integration, and also retail customization is starting to be talked about, because as part of this kind of market transformation, whether or not we reopen direct access more and more is on the table. And so that's the legislature recently opened up direct access a little bit and allowed about half the customers waiting to be served by competitive retailers to do so. And they may open the cap more and more going forward. And so that's gotten a lot of CCAs thinking about how to serve these large commercial and industrial customers, how to kind of create the internal analytics and business processes to support retail product differentiation, kind of individual customized rate structures, hedging strategies, DER integration services for these large accounts that are very sophisticated often and want those sorts of services. And that's a really exciting development from a business model standpoint. Okay, I'll kind of stop there and let Craig chime in, and then we can take questions from the audience.
Craig, do you want to contribute?
Yeah, sure. I'm going to leverage off of what Samuel was talking about when I first got on, which is, you know, all these amazing changes that are kind of swirling around as possibilities for how the electricity system is going to change here in the coming years. And he, just as I got on, Samuel was talking about SDG&E's. You know, I don't know if this is a decoy, you know, or if it's a real pursuit by SDG&E to divest their retail service. But in either case, it's a really significant change, and it's going to get people thinking about it, right? And how investor-owned utilities, you know, what that future might look like if they were to divest some portion of their existing asset base and or service responsibility. And before I comment any further on this, I'd like to just lay out the basic framework of the way that the electricity system is comprised today in California, in case not everybody's familiar with it. And even those of us who are, it's nice to just have a common framework to help guide the conversation. The grid, the electricity grid, is comprised of the transmission grid and the distribution grid. And those are there's a bright line demarcation between those two grids. It's defined by the voltage level and all that of the wires. But in general, if you have steel power poles, you're on the transmission grid. If you have wood power poles, you're on the distribution grid. And those two grids interface at transmission to distribution substations. So if you think about the transmission grid for a moment, that transmission grid is owned by what are called participating transmission owners, and these are largely the investor-owned utilities that own the transmission grid in California, and then it's other, you know, third parties that own some of the transmission assets as well. But the entire transmission grid is operated by CAISO, at least, you know, those the ones, the PTO, any part of the transmission grid that is owned by participating transmission owners. By definition, a PTO transmission asset is operated by CAISO as part of the California Independent Systems Operator. So the keeping things a little bit simple here, the transmission grid is operated by CAISO. It is owned by the participating transmission owners, which are largely the investor-owned utilities. If we take a look at the distribution grid, so where the wood power poles are, the utilities own and operate the distribution grid. And the retail service is provided by the load serving entity, which largely is the investor-owned utilities, but it is also increasingly the community choice aggregators. So we've got on the distribution grid, we've got the utilities, you know, own and operate the distribution grid, and then we've got the LSEs that provide the retail service, and the LSEs are, you know, kind of broken up between the utilities and the CCAs. So with that backdrop, here we have SDG&E making indications that they want to divest their retail service. Well, that's really interesting, right, because that basically says they're ceding it all over to the CCAs and kind of waving the white flag. But at the same time, I think if you really dig down in the details, they're hoping to make a whole bunch of money on a really large PCIA, which is, you know, kind of compensation for the existing generation that they've contracted for, and I think Samuel probably has it right that they're really only trying to retain the non-renewables portion of the utility-owned generation, and then I guess they'll sell the renewables contracts over the CCAs or whoever the buyer of those assets might be. But that's a really interesting, and whether it's a decoy by SDG&E or whether it's a real consideration, you know, strategic consideration by the board of directors there, you know, I guess time will tell. But in addition to SDG&E's, that SDG&E situation, we have Senator Jerry Hill, who is a senator in the San Mateo County area. And if those of you who are familiar with San Mateo County, that is the site, you know, that's that one of the cities in San Mateo County is San Bruno, which had a entire neighborhood blow up when PG&E's natural gas pipeline was mismanaged and you know, blew up 8 houses and killed a bunch of people. And, you know, Senator Jerry Hill has never forgotten that and feels like PG&E in particular is probably heavily mismanaged. And I think, you know, by extension would assume the same for all of the investor-owned utilities, the big ones in California. So he's got a bill that will essentially have he's talking about a bill that will force the utilities, the investor-owned utilities, to divest their transmission and distribution assets and have those basically have them become municipalized, right? In this case, maybe owned by the state of California as opposed to a city jurisdiction. In any case, turn investor-owned utility assets, poles and wires, into publicly owned poles and wires under a municipal utility type of framework. That's, to me, a very interesting play, and I'm going to just summarize here and go into what the Clean Coalition sees as really the big opportunity in this wild, wild west of the way things could you know, come together. The Clean Coalition would like to see the investor-owned utilities being forced to divest their transmission assets. Those assets are already operated by CAISO, and so there's really no operational change that would need to happen by forcing the utilities to divest their transmission assets. The reason that the Clean Coalition feels that this is such an important outcome is that right now the investor-owned utilities make a lot higher return on their investments in transmission assets. They make money on the upfront capital cost because they get a FERC jurisdictional 12% return on equity on those investments, which is considerably higher than the return on equity that they're allowed for their distribution grid investments. So right now the investor-owned utilities are really married to making investments in transmission infrastructure, which is exactly the opposite of what the Clean Coalition wants to see, which is a distributed energy resource future. You know, we want to see lots of local renewables and other local distributed energy resources as part of as driving the energy future, and not a bunch of central generation that is dependent on a whole bunch of transmission getting built out. The other piece of, in addition to the investor-owned utilities divesting their transmission investments, the other big change the Clean Coalition wants to see is the creation of DSOs. And a DSO is a distribution system operator. And whether the distribution system operator is basically a CCA that gets to also own the distribution grid, you know, that would be a fine outcome in the Clean Coalition's view of the future. Or whether it's a reconstituted investor-owned utility that is now wholly focused on the distribution grid because they no longer own transmission investments, then they're going to, whoever those players are going to be 100% focused on making sure that the distribution grid is everything that it can possibly be. And that's the future that the Clean Coalition wants to see, is some really big players that are 100% focused on local renewables and other distributed energy resources for getting as much of the energy that gets consumed off the electricity system from local sources, and to do as much balancing as possible through energy storage, demand response, et cetera, which are all, those would all be distributed energy resources. So I'm going to just stop there and see how I might be able to add some more commentary as the conversation goes along.
Daniel.
One second here before we go on. I would like to have Rick Riefstein add anything. Is anything new going on in Massachusetts, Rick? He's from Boston University, and they work with CCAs over there.
I'm sorry. I jumped on the call rather late and just heard the tail end of what I just heard. I was really interested to hear the term distributed system operator, and I wish I had heard that term in all the discussions around here. I think that's exactly what we need. So I'm not sure what I can say that's really on point at this moment. We do have at Boston University efforts in this direction at the new Institute of Sustainable Energy. I don't know if you've linked up yet with Peter Fox Penner, Sierra. But I would recommend that you contact him. He would probably be a lot better able to answer the question that you just asked me. about what's going on. My focus in this past semester has been sort of not system focused. I've been looking at things like residential building energy efficiency efforts and community solar, where to locate community solar. So I haven't been paying as much attention to the grid transformation issues that I think you're talking about right now. So I'm not as up to date on that.
Okay. Yeah, that's fine. Carol, do you have anything to add on that, or David Kay from New York? Carrie's from Massachusetts as well. Either one of you? Okay. All right. So go ahead, Samuel, with what we were discussing.
Okay. I had a few more insights to add, and then I was going to try and kind of wrap it up at a high level. So in the PCIA proceeding that's going forward, which again is, you know, broadly addressing the question of what do we do with all of the contracts that the utilities hold and all of their assets as all the customers go to CCAs, the next phase is going to look at more structural solutions. So not just how do we calculate above market costs and share them with, you know, assign them to CCA customers and bundled service customers, but also like prepayment options. Could a CCA kind of prepay its obligations and get out from that? Could there be some sort of recurring allocation or auction mechanism where we do back-to-back contracts, for example, for slices of the utility portfolios that retailers and CCAs want to take title to for a certain term. And as part of this, there's also a really interesting discussion about drilling down on how the utilities have been managing their portfolios. You know, are these fair to assign these costs? Were these costs really unavoidable, right? So we're going to get into portfolio optimization techniques and metrics and areas for cost reduction or kind of, you know, managing the contracts more actively. And that's something that hasn't been, you know, that's a very powerful area to explore in California, because I think a lot of us have this sense that the utilities could be managing their portfolios more competitively, more actively. And that's already starting to bear fruit in some regards. I've been hearing from asset owners who are under contract with the utilities that they're starting to get more interest in how to restructure contracts, how to derive more revenues or, you know, optimization potential from the assets under management. So that's all a good thing for all of us, I think, statewide. You know, looking ahead, there is kind of a wave of recognition across the country and that investor-owned utility business models really have to be reformed. They can't, you know, the current structure where they're paid a guaranteed profit based on the capital they invest into distribution grid infrastructure can't really be reconciled to a future in which we want to shift a lot of investment to the grid edge and into distributed energy resources. And so I think Hawaii is the leading example of this. Their legislature just passed a law requiring that their utilities shift to performance-based rate making. Oregon is also looking at this, Minnesota, Rhode Island. There's a lot of states around the country that have, you know, this has been an issue that's been talked a lot for a while, and now we're finally starting to see some real action on it. And with that also, there was a very interesting survey of utility executives that recently released, where 80% of investor-owned utility executives now think that they do have to begin to reform their business models and begin to shift to performance-based rate making to be in alignment with where, you know, all their stakeholders want the industry to go. And to tee off of what Craig said about the distribution system operator, you know, California has built out probably 3 nuclear power plants worth of distributed energy resources with no real centralized tracking, let alone monitoring, let alone the ability to control and optimize these assets. And so we really need to do that. And so as part of this market transformation, what I'm hoping and will be encouraging is a discussion of what that looks like. You know, what are the broad brushstrokes? Do we reform the utilities business models? How do we get them out of the generation business? How do we, should we be putting in place a platform that, you know, across, maybe even across all of the utilities, all the distribution utilities, that allows and standardizes how distributed energy resources are integrated into, you know, the retail side, the network side, the markets, into portfolio management, and allows a variety of different load-serving entities, different CCAs, different retailers to interface with network operations through that platform. I think that's really where we want to be pushing in order to effectively accelerate the market for distributed energy and really make use of all the asset attributes of that very diverse class of technologies. And again, we've been seeing that sort of activity in different regions, not necessarily in America yet, to my knowledge, but there are pilots. But in other countries like Australia and New Zealand, for example, they are putting in place that sort of standardized platform across multiple distribution companies and retailers. So it's all possible now, and I think it's necessary. And so this California is just a bit of a mess right now in terms of what the problems are and how we should go forward. But it provides the opportunity to really, for CCAs, I believe, to define their vision of the future, to draw on what other states and other countries are doing to leverage all of that and to provide a clear path forward to the market structure that really is in alignment with our rapid decarbonization goals. I'll leave it there.
Okay. Jerry, do you have anything to add to this?
Which Jerry?
Jerry Brock.
Thank you. Just one thing, just looking at it from the point of view of a single CCA trying to grapple with the chaos, I think I agree with Sam, California is an exciting mess. But one thing I'm seeing is, and I'll give you a specific example, that our county CCA, because of the exit fee decision, because it started up, delayed the startup long enough not to have reserves build up to keep rates where they were promised, the RCCA basically decided to take the opportunity not to enroll the 8,000 or so solar customers in the service area. And to me, I've been trying to get my head around that decision. And what it means to me is that some of the positive things that the other speakers have talked about in terms of CCA's role in local integration, local optimization of distributed and local resources. What has happened, just the CPUC decision on exit fees really has put a big crimp in the momentum in that direction and shifted the CCA's focus back to, you know, purchasing and reselling wholesale electricity rather than this issue, the exciting opportunity of really doing a better job of integrating local resources and managing the local grids in a more integrative and proactive way. That is the future. So I guess I'm just basically affirming that what some of the speakers have said is true, that things are in some ways, you know, the in some ways the doors are being opened to fresh thinking and new ideas. At the same time, the folks who are in a position to do things in terms of local integration and local resource development are being, you know, are being tasked to, you know, just get through the next couple of years with a viable business. So that would be my comment.
All right. Rob Hammond, do you have anything to say on this?
I have a question.
Go ahead.
I've been working with builders on zero net energy homes for many, many years, and most recently working to build some zero net energy communities and finding difficulties that would be solved by integrating a community solar system into a local system where the homes all have solar on the roof, but it's not possible for various reasons to get enough solar on all the roofs to be a net zero community without the support of a community system. The question is, where does virtual net metering enter into this discussion, or is it too far down the chain for this particular group? Clarified. I think virtual net metering is a critical component of being able to make community systems viable, and flip that. It's required in order to make zero net energy communities possible.
This is Rick. I can throw one thing on the table here. I've been in conversations with at least one CCA who understands the values you're talking about, and would like to explore a model where they take some of their largest customers and engage them in a process where they would sign up for 20 years to be involved in a joint procurement of local resources. So we put the CCA puts out an RFP for, say, 15 to 20 megawatts. They get, you know, 4 to 5 large municipal agencies to agree to basically sign up for a 20-year power purchase agreement for that power. And by doing it at that kind of scale, you can start to get pricing that, while it's not equivalent to what a utility scale would provide, it is maybe only 15 to 20% more. And the benefit to the CCA ratepayers is that their largest customers, who are frankly the ones that are the most profitable for the CCA, are locked in for 20 years. So there are ideas around that. That particular idea was part of a set of programmatic concepts that the board of the CCA was going to be actually considering this month. But now that this PCIA exit fee problem has come along, their ability to consider these kind of innovative approaches gets somewhat constrained because there's a cost to doing that, and they may not be able to afford that cost right now that they're going to have to use some of their reserves to offset these increases that these exit fees are providing. So we're hopeful that kind of a project might be able to go forward there in some other communities. We're working with a couple other CCAs on innovative programmatic approaches to do use local resources, solar and storage and other DERs to do load shaving or load shifting to reduce their wholesale procurement costs. But again, that takes staff time and staff resources that may have to be dialed back for the moment until this issue gets resolved around the PCIA.
And just to address, the virtual net metering in California is only allowed for, I think, multifamily low-income customers, the utility tariff. And so we would, you know, if we wanted to expand virtual net metering, we would have to, it'd be a political issue to take up with the commission, possibly the legislature. So CCAs could do that. I'm not aware of any discussions to expand that. It's related to the shift to a more DER-oriented platform for integration. Because once you have that in place, you can really kind of start to add in, you know, avoided costs on the distribution grid as an adder, kind of what those systems could do if they had any sort of, you know, smart inverter controls or a bit of battery storage as well, kind of what that's worth and what sort of value stream it could create from the distribution grid operations. And so it kind of gets a lot of the benefits of virtual net metering without the disadvantages from a system optimization perspective of having a static tariff that treats every system like that as the same, even though the grid topology is different. To tee off of what Rick was talking about, you know, there's really a cultural fork in the road that I see with certain CCAs looking at this decrease to their margin and going into kind of cost-cutting mode. And then CCAs looking at this and seeing, you know, seeing this as pressure for them to think harder about how they can deploy new services and ways of creating value to increase their bottom line. And so, for example, Rick was saying, you know, you're working on ways to start using local resources in an intelligent fashion that will lower the cost for the CCA on the wholesale side. That's the type of activity that I've been encouraging and the perspective I've been encouraging. And not just for kind of programs, but for putting in place the business architecture, the analytics and the processes to really begin to target individual customers, groups of customers, and to deploy DER in an intelligent way with retail rate structure in a way that supports that integration. To target the sources of peak, to target the sources of uncertainty that drive a lot of the costs on the hexing side, and to begin to deploy and integrate DER in an intelligent fashion at a very granular, targeted level. I'll leave it there.
Anybody else?
If I can just clarify some of the problem that we're having, I'm talking about new developments that they're not necessarily large ones. Could be 100 homes. Could be a few more than that. Could be a master developed community of a few thousand homes. But in any case, when that's built out. Take the 100 home example. There's no representative of that community once the builder's done, and so I don't know how they would fit into a forming a CCA. They're probably too small in the first place. In the second place, there's just no entity that would have the capability of doing that. So it seems like virtual net metering seems like the right approach. And I understand that nobody's pursuing this at the moment, but I'm wondering what are the barriers other than legislative? What are the barriers that somebody who brought legislation to bear on this problem? Why is it really an issue?
Are you in California?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Do you know the Building Decarbonization Initiative?
Yes.
Okay. That and that's a forum in which CCAs are active. There's utility representatives building trades, and they are right now hammering out a lot of kind of position papers and identifying various issues and ways to accelerate zero net energy. And so perhaps that's a forum to take this up in.
Okay.
Yeah.
Any other thoughts here? I'd like to interject one thing that has happened recently that not related to CCAs, but I think it's extremely important, is that Boulder is continuing in its direction of municipalizing, and recently is in the process of acquiring Xcel Energy's assets. Xcel Energy, on the other hand, has committed to 100% renewable energy by 2050. So what I've gotten out of that is that putting pressure on a utility can work, and the threat of losing Boulder, which we're not going to go with Xcel Energy anyhow, was enough pressure to make them reconsider what they were doing, and it kind of spurred a lot of other outlying communities to Boulder to want to have renewables on their agenda as well. So I thought that was important.
I have something to add there, Sierra. This is Samuel.
Sure.
So I was involved with Boulder's Energy Future, that campaign, and we reframed the debate to be around energy localization and intelligent, you know, smart grid applications early on, and everyone really liked that. It was very positive about it. Xcel's behavior towards the municipality was kind of, you know, go pound sand. So they put, you know, their counteroffer was, we'll build you a wind farm, and you can just take title to that for like 20 years. And just from a risk management and rate standpoint, it was not a good idea. And so they got a lot of blowback from that. And they learned, I think, from that culturally that, you know, they had to be more of a credible counterparty to municipalities that were seeking to accelerate decarbonization efforts. And so I think the next city that did that was maybe Minneapolis. And in response, Xcel actually created what they call a clean energy partnership there. And the Institute for Local Self-Reliance was involved in this. John Farrell, he's still involved. And they've actually created like a formal governance structure with, you know, representatives of the city council, and they have a community committee and the utilities involved. And they're really getting into the details and working on a regular basis with each other on a number of initiatives to support, you know, accelerating efficiency, local jobs, you know. So I, you know, to end this on a positive note, I think that the lessons learned for investor-owned utilities that control, you know, 70% of this, of the country's territory or customer base, they're really starting, I think, to realize that they need to reform their business models to be performance-based, to embrace distributed energy, and increasingly to work with local community groups and local municipalities for how to best do that in different geographic areas. You know, not that it's all good news. It's going to be a huge, it's going to be a pretty protracted process around the country, but I do get the general sense culturally that we're tilting in the right direction.
Yes, I agree with you. And they cited one of the reasons that they decided to go in the direction of renewables was the pressure from the cities, and also the reduced energy cost of renewables being lower costs than fossil fuel. So I think that direction is really encouraging. And this, and also Wisconsin, apparently their utility, one of them, is also moving in the direction of 100% renewables. So this is important to know that cities can make a difference. Anybody else here? Just about ready to end? A couple minutes? Anybody? Okay. Cool. No, go ahead.
Well, I just want to kind of reflect on Sam's comment. You know, what I think there's good news and bad news. I think the bad news is that it's very difficult for local jurisdictions to have a conversation with a counterparty that is in the process of figuring out what its business model will be in the future. And there isn't a lot of bandwidth to support that conversation from the local jurisdiction's point of view. And I guess I want to bring us back to, you know, the forum is really municipal sustainability and energy, and the municipal part needs to be remembered in this. There's not much an individual jurisdiction can do other than watch all of the, you know, the shifting of policies and so forth at the macro level or at the state level or national level. The local jurisdictions, you know, can do things, but it needs some stability some stability in the energy sector in order to play an effective role.
Yeah, that's a very good point institutionally. I think once the utility and once the kind of, you know, the regulators and the legislatures start to realize that the business models have to be reformed, at that point it starts opening up conversations potentially between the utilities and between the municipalities and community groups to support that direction. And so, you know, what I would suggest is that municipalities start to discuss this as a policy goal, that they get together and they kind of discuss how reforming their utilities business model will benefit their communities, and start to spread awareness of that and lobby for that to get the, maybe to accelerate the process politically.
Agree.
All right. Well, we're out of time. So thanks for everybody for coming, and thanks for our presenters for being here. Interesting conversation. And hope to see you next time. We've got an interesting call going on Monday as well, talking about how universities can work with cities on facilitating some of these renewable energy projects and working with utilities. So, appreciate anybody who wants to join that conversation, and hope to see you all then.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks, Sierra.
Thanks, everybody.